it's also important not to defeat oneself before you get started. Liberals and progressives are notorious for telling you what isn't possible. But now we have Trump. So, and anything is possible if you fight hard enough, long enough, and act strategically enough. We're not fighting for a particular candidate. We're not fighting for a party. We're not even fighting necessarily for, you know, a particular set of policies. What we're fighting for is complete social transformation, because the center cannot hold any longer. What we want to do is change the whole system to the point that the Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warrens become the right wing of the Democratic Party.
That's Arun Gupta, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Arun Gupta on changing the system. With Donald Trump in the White House, we may have entered a post-truth era. As Orwell wrote in his great essay, Looking Back on the Spanish War, if the leader says of such and such an event, it never happened, well, it never happened. If he says that 2 and 2 are 5, well, 2 and 2 are 5. Orwell added, this prospect frightens me much more than bombs. Today, in a country where magical thinking is heard at the highest levels of government, facts are up for grabs. You have your narrative, and I have mine. Recall Trump aide Kellyanne Conway's infamous comment about alternative facts. Are we sliding toward a dystopian future? Not necessarily. Informed and organized people, unafraid and willing to challenge power, can change the system. Our guest today is Arun Gupta. He's an independent journalist and activist. His articles appear in Alternet, Truthout, The Guardian, and Z. He also appears on Democracy Now! He spoke at the Baltimore Nonviolence Center.
Let's admit straight out that the election was traumatic. Everyone who opposed Trump was struck by fear, depression, anger, or panic. So it's important to take that anger and fear and depression and pour that energy into organizing for the greater good, for a tolerant, rational, pluralistic, and most of all, just society. Now, to know where we're going in the Trump years, we have to know how we got here. It's simply the tale of how the left goes from advocating for socialism to, during the 1930s and 40s, New Deal Keynesianism, to the defeats it suffered at the hands of McCarthyism and Reaganism. Then it's about the ascendancy of neoliberalism, the third way politics of Bill Clinton, and finally the progressive neoliberalism of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. But it's also an older story. It's a story of socialism and barbarism, which Rosa Luxemburg wrote about in 1915 during the Great War. She wrote, "We face a choice, either the triumph of imperialism and the collapse of all civilization as in ancient Rome, depopulation, desolation, degeneration, a great cemetery, or the victory of socialism, the conscious active struggle of international workers against imperialism and its method of war." So, how did Trump win? Simply put, it's because the Democrats abandoned working class politics with Bill Clinton's victory in 1992. Then with Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign, they abandoned the working class itself. Clinton's campaign said, if we all remember, for every blue-collar white worker we lose in the industrial Midwest, we'll win 2 Republican-leaning women in the suburbs. Well, Clinton lost many of the white workers who usually go Democratic, and she gained no more Republican women. It was a brilliantly stupid strategy. Abandon your base and ask your opponents to vote for one of the most reviled politicians ever. I recently met with workers in Indiana reporting for the Raw Story. They work at 3 factories that are being dismantled and sent to Monterrey, Mexico. 2 plants are owned by the Carrier Corporation. They make furnaces for the home and controls for furnaces, air conditioners, and that sort of things. The 3rd company is owned by Rexnord. They make industrial and agricultural ball bearings. Now, the significance of these 3 companies is Trump singled them out during the campaign, during and right after his victory in 2016. He said he attacked both companies, saying, you know, they're viciously firing people and no more. No more offshoring is going to happen. And then a few weeks after he was elected, while he was still president-elect, he turned the screws on Carrier. And to great fanfare, he flew into Indianapolis and announced that there are all these jobs going to be saved. And it was all these accolades he got. He misrepresented how many jobs that were going to be saved, or in his parlance, he lied. He got up there and said over 1,100 jobs were going to be saved. In fact, it was only 730 union jobs and 70 clerical and supervisory jobs. He never mentioned that 550 workers were going to still lose their jobs. And at the two other factories, which he also singled out for offshoring, the Rexnord facility and another Carrier facility in Huntington, which is in northern Indiana, over 1,000 workers were slated to lose their jobs. And now that has been finalized. So all told, yes, he did save 730 jobs, but over 1,600 workers are going to lose their jobs. He also made a big deal about how the state of Indiana is going to be giving $7 million. That's how they got him to stay. And Carrier is going to be investing $16 million in its Indianapolis facility. What he didn't explain is that $16 million is in automation. And the CEO admitted shortly afterwards, well, automation means you're going to lose jobs. So, in fact, what Trump's deal, job-saving deal, did is it involved the state of Indiana paying one of the most profitable corporations in America. This is a Fortune 50 company, its parent company, United Technologies, paying them to destroy jobs, right? So this is part of the hypocrisy of Trump, but it was very effective. And these jobs that are being lost, they pay $15 to $25 an hour, or even a little more. They're a job you can get actually without a high school degree. A lot of the workers just have GEDs. They're the type of rare jobs for blue-collar workers that still exist. They can allow someone to start a family, buy a house, raise a children, and even potentially hope they can have a simple retirement one day. I interviewed 17 workers, all of them union workers. They're either in the steel workers or the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Half of them voted for Trump, even though they were losing their, they're losing their jobs. Among those who voted for Clinton, they would say things, "We're tired of broken promises," or "She's the lesser evil." The commonality among the workers is one after another blasted NAFTA as to why the jobs were disappearing. John Feltner, a 47-year-old employee at Rexnord and a new grandfather, is losing his job. He said the NAFTA bill is still fresh in people's minds. The international union was all vote Democrat. Then companies announce jobs going away, and it's because of NAFTA. The workers connect that to the Democrats, and Hillary was saddled with that. Among the half of the Trump supporters, half of the workers who voted for Trump, all of them still support Trump. All of them are also losing their jobs. And Feltner said, well, we knew what we're going to get with Hillary. We don't know what we're going to get with Trump. We still don't know. It's a shot in the dark, but it's a shot. Don Ziering, he is the president of the steelworkers unit at Rexnord. He said he voted for the candidate who didn't win. But he asked, if Trump could do what he did with Carrier, and he wasn't even the president, why didn't Obama do it? That was a common sentiment among all the workers. If Trump could do this, then where have the Democrats been when they've occupied the White House for the 16 of the last 24 years? These workers also have a far sharper sense of their own self-interest than liberals like Paul Krugman give them credit for. He claims that white working-class Trump supporters voted against their own interests. I only met one worker who voted against her own interest, and she voted for Hillary Clinton. Lakita Clark has put in 15 years at the Carrier plant in Indianapolis. She says, I wasn't big on Hillary, but I supported her. I'm all for voting for a woman president, but I was rooting for Bernie. I liked him more than Hillary. In Clark's view, she said, despite the fact she voted for Hillary Clinton, she said, if Hillary won, we would still be out of a job. So she was voting against her own interests there. And Clark also noted, with better insight than most pundits, that if Clinton had picked Bernie Sanders as her VP, she would have won. Now, among other workers, I talked to Travis Michael. He's losing his job of 16 years at the Carrier plant in Huntington, which is moving to Monterey. He said something needs a change, or we're going to be jumping the wall and going to Mexico. Everyone's going to be working at McDonald's and Walmart. When it comes to politics, Michael says, I think Democrats do more for working people. With Republicans, the rich are getting richer. But he still voted for Trump. He says, I got my hopes up that if Trump could save the Carrier plant, he could save us as well. Now, Carrier and Rexnord workers are clear. They don't want anyone's sympathy. They want people's solidarity. They want people to stand with them. But when you talk to them, there are hints of desperation that come out. Foreclosed homes, failed marriages, struggling as a single parent, chronic health problems, especially diabetes and heart conditions, trying to reinvent themselves in their 50s in a brutal economy for blue-collar workers. And these are some of the best-paid blue-collar workers in the Midwest. If they lose their foothold in unionized factories, they could very well descend into the Walmart and McDonald's economy. And here, desperation and poverty is the daily bread. Low-wage workers describe surviving on $25 a week for groceries, going hungry, duct-taping shoes together, living one couple or even one family per room in an apartment, working injured for months out of fear of being fired if they take time off to see the doctor, not having enough money to put gas in their tank to get to work. They have no savings, no possibility of owning a home, and little hope of ever retiring. Now, the Carrier and Rexnord workers also often mentioned how the Republicans are anti-worker, but many of them still voted for Trump. Since 1992, Democrats have been pushing free trade deals, neoliberalism, pro-Wall Street, and anti-union policies. They push many union members to the edge. Most labor leaders are essentially oblivious, or they act like they're oblivious. They have no strategy to rebuild working-class power or organization. Now, the one candidate that Carrier and Rexnord workers were excited about was Bernie Sanders. He was someone that many saw as really as a champion of the working people who had stood with them for decades. Even those who didn't support Sanders said that he was sincere and they liked what he had to say. They just questioned how he was going to pay for it. Many of the workers simply also despise Wall Street, making comments like millions and millions of jobs are leaving the country and the fat cats are getting fatter. But Hillary Clinton and the Democrats gave these workers no reason to vote for them and many reasons to vote against them. Now, enter Trump. What he really did was successfully racialize class politics. The two, of course, are inseparable in American history. Capitalism developed here hand in hand with racism. Wealth was created from the land and natural resources through the genocide of Native Americans. Enormous profits were earned from the slave economy in the form of cotton exports, and huge amounts of capital were held in African bodies. By some measures, half the wealth in the mid-19th century was in slaves, half the capital in the United States. So what he did was use that racial politics very deftly. He told Americans, Mexicans are taking our jobs. China is dumping their goods here. Muslims and refugees are weakening us. Illegals are stealing our tax dollars. But we have to remember that just back in 2008, Obama won a lot of the white working class, significantly more than Clinton did in 2016. Obama flipped traditional southern states from red to blue, like Virginia and North Carolina. And in Indiana, where these factory workers are, he won that state despite the fact that it was 84% white. In 2016, Trump won it by nearly 20 points. So we can't reduce politics to economic issues. And this is where one of the most important and underappreciated concepts of modern politics comes in, what's called libidinal politics. Now, the libido is simply the energy focused on achieving pleasure, such as eating ice cream, watching a football game, hiking in the woods, lying on the beach on a sunny day. What Trump did was appeal to the American way of life from which we get pleasure and satisfaction. So Trump would talk about bad hombres and George Soros. They get their pleasure in a way that keeps real Americans from realizing theirs. He would say it's the power-hungry globalists, the lazy welfare recipients, the illegals who cannot control themselves and wait their turn. They deprive us of our rightful pleasures. They are against America because Americans are hardworking and willing to wait their turn. And this is some of the exact wording I heard from workers at these factories in Indiana. They use terminology like this. I doubt any of them could explain libidinal politics, but they buy into it. One union worker who said he wants to help Trump make America great again said his main concerns were jobs and immigration. He said he and his Filipino wife went through a time-consuming and difficult immigration process, but they did it the right way, and everyone else should. In other words, he was implying they played by the rules, they waited their turns, they did the hard work, but illegals just sneak in and ruin it for everyone. Now, this is just an explanation, not a justification. Folks may remember the Mexican-American Trump surrogate who went on TV and warned there will be a taco truck on every corner if we don't do something about immigration. Now, this was really absurd, but it's also brilliant. This is zero-sum libidinal politics. What he was saying is Mexicans get their pleasure through having a taco truck on the corner, and it's a manifestation of how white America is being displaced and overrun and being denied their pleasure, all in the form of a taco. It's very simple for people to grasp. Clinton tried to play the same game as well. She offered, but it was much weaker. She had a we're stronger together. She tried to use melting pot nationalism. Trump drew upon nationalist pleasure from guns to the anti-Mexican line. It's appeal to power and authority. Guns are not only a much easier sell, it's a much stronger imagery of the phallus. It enhanced Trump's macho appeal, and it also displayed the mobilizing power of sexism against Clinton. Now, libidinal politics can also explain how and why Trump used birtherism so effectively. His portrayal of Obama as foreign-born, of course completely ridiculous, makes Obama a manifestation of foreign subversion weakening America. It's much easier to believe that we're beset by enemies from the outside than having to question long-held cherished beliefs that America is the greatest country on earth. It's also why Trump voters brush off allegations of Russia hacking DNC emails. If you accept this as true, or that it mattered, it had an effect on the election, that would mean Trump supporters would have to question all their beliefs in Trump. They'd have to question the last 2 years of the campaign as his presidency. And they'd also have to question the whole idea of making America great again. It's easier to brush aside inconvenient facts. But before we condemn them or think that they're dumb, remember this happens with progressives all the time. How many brushed aside Obama, the Nobel Peace Prize winning president, becoming the drone killer in chief? How many ignored that in 2011 he was illegally bombing 7 countries at once? That despite all the talk about working on climate change, he effectively undermined a meaningful climate change mitigation during his presidency. And what he really did was he protected Wall Street banks at every turn, did little for the working class, and oversaw a disastrous home foreclosure program that saw the foreclosure of 9 million homes to aid the banks. There's an excellent Washington Post piece on this. So what can we say who and what Trump represents? A question that has been asked a lot, is Trump a fascist? And simply, no, he's not. Fascism is not about particular attributes, which is how the discussion usually goes. Like, there's a checklist, and if you check off enough boxes, you're a fascist. Fascism is a dynamic. It's a historical process. It's even an anthropological process. Trump does not promote eugenics like the Nazis did. There's no totalitarian ideology like Mussolini, who said all within the state, nothing outside the state, nothing against the state. There's no militia party like the Nazi brown shirts or Mussolini's black shirts. Nazis were against big business. They were anti-individualistic, anti-hedonistic. That's everything Trump is for. So fascism is ultimately a dynamic, the creation of a new man devoted to the realization of the revolutionary and imperialistic policies of the totalitarian society. But Trump is opening the door to fascism. His proposals, such as to register Muslims, deport refugees, round up, intern, and deport millions of immigrants, is ethnic cleansing. This is a constant of U.S. history. Native genocide, slave codes, anti-Catholic riots, and anti-Chinese pogroms in the 19th century, the terror of the Klan, Jim Crow, anti-black massacres, particularly in the World War I era, the massacre of thousands of Chicanos in the Southwest, often led by state forces, the Texas Rangers, Japanese internment, and forced relocation and cultural destruction of Native Americans. So Trump and his ideology are very much all-American, at least all-American ethnic cleansing. So fascism also involves a war against sections of the working class. Trump and the right want to destroy unions through a national right to work law. Attacks on immigrants should also be seen as an attack on workers. Same with the attack on Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter has started to effectively work together with low-wage worker movements. These are all attacks on working class. And I think we can even see the attacks on Muslims as attacks on the working class, because many of them are. There's a few million Muslims, and a large portion are working class, and the attacks make them very vulnerable, even if they are U.S. citizens. But this isn't 1930s fascism. There are no death camps. It's more a combination of bringing the war of terror home, combined with Koch brothers' vision of America. This is also the same as Ayn Rand's extreme authoritarian capitalism. And in fact, many of Trump's appointees are devotees of Ayn Rand, as is House Speaker Paul Ryan. Trump is more in the mold of European ethno-nationalists, like France's Marine Le Pen, Britain's Nigel Farage, and Vladimir Putin, of course. But I think we can understand Trump more by looking to the global South. He's an authoritarian strongman like Augusto Pinochet, and his contemporaries are India's Hindu chauvinist Narendra Modi, Philippines' Death Squad president Rodrigo Duterte, and Turkey's Islamist president Erdogan. Now, how Trump is going to rule is also distinct. It's going to be different than the Bush era, which used disinformation, spin, and the talk of they would create their own realities. Trumpism is much more about confusion and conspiracism, disorientation and disequilibrium. The strategy is to keep the public completely off balance so they can no longer distinguish between fact and fiction. Trumpism is even post-satire. How do you parody a movement in which large numbers of people actually believe Pizzagate was real, right? This was the absolutely bizarre conspiracy that a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. had secret tunnels leading to underground chambers that held children as sex slaves for high-ranking Democrats, including Hillary Clinton. So how do we counter all this? It can't simply be done through protesting, though that is an important tactic. But it's not a strategy. Single-issue movements have limited effectiveness. Reactive politics is a dead end. Trump will push so many horrendous policies that organizers, progressives, nonprofits, organized labor will quickly be overwhelmed and divided. They will be fighting desperate defensive battles on isolated fronts, even as the ground is collapsing beneath them. Now, an important aspect of the battles ahead is this is a battle about ideology. In the 1970s, Keynesianism failed. Keynesianism was the idea that the New Deal idea that the state had a primary role to play in managing the capitalist economy. It would bring together various forces such as business and labor. It would use its fiscal power. It would use capital controls to smooth out the business cycle. The focus was full employment. But by the 1970s, the system started to unravel. Basically, there was in the United States, there was the pressures from the Vietnam War, the huge expenditures, and the whole Cold War economy, which is a very kind of inefficient military Keynesianism, right? It's a lot more, it's a lot easier, costs a lot less money to have people like building bridges or national parks or schools than it is to have them building aircraft carriers and tanks and jet planes. So there was the economic pressure in terms of the fiscal policy, but then you also had the upsurge of all the new social movements, the Black Liberation Movement, the Women's Movement, the Gay Liberation Movement, Chicano Movement, American Indian Movement. We had a society that was moving beyond the idea that the heterosexual white male was at the center of it, and that everyone should be able to get a slice of the pie. And of course, there were enough resources. But in the early 1970s, and this was going on in many countries, it was going on in the U.S., in Britain, in the Scandinavian welfare states, that you can either go to the left or you can go to the right. The center could not hold anymore. So that's when we see the counter-reaction of neoliberalism come in with Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher in particular, but this also included Pinochet in Chile and Deng Xiaoping in China. Now what we have, this has evolved to the progressive neoliberalism associated with the Clintons. What Bill Clinton did in 1992 was he basically convinced the Democratic Party, and he had a vehicle to do this, the Democratic Leadership Council. Their idea is we need to shift the party to the right. We can no longer be tarred as being soft on crime or soft on welfare. We have to be pro-Wall Street. And this became third way. Third way simply means that there's a middle way between capitalism and socialism. But what it really was a capitulation to capitalism. What the Clintonites were saying, we will better manage the capitalist economy to create more jobs, more economic growth, and we'll trickle down a little bit in the form of social welfare. And because of some various accidents, such as the end of the Cold War and the interregnum before September 11th, as well as the internet bubble, the economy boomed during the 90s. So a lot of people fondly remember the Bill Clinton era as a time of prosperity. Now, what that's evolved to is what can be called progressive neoliberalism. What this does, it brings together the liberal elements of feminism, anti-racism, multiculturalism, LGBTQ rights, and the high-end symbolic and service-based business sectors. That's Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood. Progressive social forces are joined with the forces of cognitive capitalism, especially financialization. However, unwittingly, the former, the social movement, lends charisma to the latter. Ideals like diversity and empowerment, which could in principle serve different ends, now gloss policies that have devastated manufacturing and what once were middle class lives. This is what Hillary Clinton was trying to sell in her campaign that ended so disastrously. So while she lost white men and white workers by a greater margin than Obama did in 2012, she also lost African Americans by a greater margin, and Latinos, and Asians, and Muslims. And her firewall was supposed to be women. She made a scant 1-point gain among women. I mean, how the hell do you do worse among Latinos and Muslims compared to Trump than Obama did to Romney? So I think one thing that is important, because there's a lot of people are saying, we can't relitigate the election. And they're saying we can't relitigate the election because what they're trying to do is salvage third way politics, right? Even though the center cannot hold, right? This is this cycle that we've seen, or this kind of rhythm we've seen through politics for over a century. You know, whether it's socialism or barbarism, Keynesianism or neoliberalism, and now progressive neoliberalism and this kind of proto-fascistic politics. Policies of Donald Trump. What the Obama and Clinton wing of the Democratic Party is doing is they're trying to salvage third way politics. So it's important that, yes, one can point to a lot of specific factors as to what in the end may have tipped the election. But in the end, don't blame Russia, don't blame Comey's letter, don't blame racism or sexism. They all had an effect. But the race should have never been so close that even all these elements combined could have tipped the election.
You're listening to Arun Gupta on Changing the System. This is Alternative Radio, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. For details on how to obtain a copy of this program, please call 04-1359-7828. Or visit the Alternative Radio website at araustralia.org. Please stay tuned for the end of the program and further details on ordering.
What we saw simply was that the center could not hold. And we know this because of Bernie Sanders' run. You know, he did extraordinarily well. He never expected to win. Basically, his senior advisors and his wife admitted to the New York Times that they were only running a protest campaign in the beginning. And they actually had a strategy to win, but they never executed that strategy. The strategy was he would have to campaign full-time, win the first three states, which he nearly did, Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada, and then that would have broken the Clinton inevitability. But they never expected that he would do so well. And same with Trump. It's clear he never expected to do so well. So there was something else going on. The center cannot hold. Now, Trump is a rejection of this progressive neoliberalism, but he's a right-wing rejection. He's an authoritarian taking capitalism to new extremes. And the carrier deal that he struck to save those 730 jobs is telling. Because what it is all power flows through the great leader, right? He's also attacking unions, what all these workers support, unionized workers who are voting for a president who's vowing to destroy their unions. Trump is the essentially the all-powerful father figure. Who needs unions? Who needs regulations? Or who needs the progressive state? Of course, he wants the repressive state. But who needs all that when you have a powerful leader like Trump who, through sheer will, can rain down jobs, kickstart the economy, and reinvigorate national virility? How do we respond to all this? Well, I think there are, first of all, some principles that we need to really articulate and be firm about. One is being rigorous and scientific, being skeptical, demanding sourcing, verifiable evidence, and be cautious about drawing conclusions. Now, it's important to fight fake news on the right, but there's also a lot of conspiracism among liberals and progressives and leftists. Half. Let me repeat that. Half of all Clinton voters think that Russia hacked vote tallies. There's absolutely no evidence of this. This is a total lie. So how's this any different than all the Trump voters who believe that Clinton won the popular election because millions of illegals voted for her, right? There's this attitude now, I think, in some quarters that, well, we fight their lies by promoting lies of our own. But all that does is strengthen Trump in the end. Another important principle going forward is we need everyone. We're basically entering a period where neo-McCarthyism is a real possibility. The right, the hard right, corporations are going to attack unions. They'll attack the left, liberals, and progressives. And that means we need real solidarity. And solidarity means defending people you don't like. We need to defend anyone attacked by the Trump administration and the alt-right. The alt-right is just the term for the white supremacist right. And they need to be defended no matter how much you may personally dislike them. Trump is going to go, it's speculation, but we should also be wary of it, that he will go much further than the Nixon administration, which used the IRS as a weapon. Trump will use the FBI, the IRS, the NSA, the huge right-wing media and social media apparatus to hound, prosecute, jail, and destroy their enemies. So it's okay to disagree, even strongly, but we need to remember who the real enemy is in the end. Now, there's one idea that's been floating around, this guide called the Indivisible Guide. It was put out by former Democratic congressional staffers. And basically, their idea was progressives need to adopt the Tea Party playbook. And frankly, that's just never going to work, right? There is no Fox News for socialism. There are no billionaires who want to fund anarchists, right? That's what the Tea Party had right from the beginning. The Tea Party was very much a very real movement. It was, we can call it this kind of white revanchism, this nostalgia for a white society, culture, and dominance. And it's a pretty much a straight line from the Tea Party to Donald Trump. But this guide does have some useful tips, you know, in terms of how to bird dog Congress, how to go after your congressional members. The fact is the Wall Street Democrats are not your allies. The Democrats want to try and own the opposition. They're in a desperate bid to try and put themselves in control of all the opposition to the Trump, when the Wall Street Democrats are in many ways an even bigger problem than the Republicans. Because as the workers in Indiana at Carrier, you know, were saying, you know, We know the Republicans are already the enemy, but the problem is the Democrats are as well. So if the Democrats don't offer any opposition, any real opposition to these right-wing pro-corporate policies, people are going to cast about for a savior wherever they can find them because they get so desperate. And that's what led to Trump. And just so we're clear that the Wall Street Democrats, you know, are certainly no one's friends, let's remember, even before Trump was inaugurated, it was Wall Street Democrats who killed a pharmaceutical bill to allow for the reimportation of cheap pharmaceuticals. It was 13 Democrats in the Senate who helped to kill that bill. People are talking about primarying Democrats in 2018. This is probably going to be really premature. The left, progressives, organized labor does not have a base of power yet. And I'll talk about this a little more. But where the power should really be built is at the municipal and county level. Now, there's another area where resistance can be very effective against the Trump administration, and that's federal workers. They're going to be on the front lines of resisting Trump, and it's important that they resist. Now, it's not just to preserve the role and the idea that government can serve as a positive force in society, but simply to save their own hides. Trump and his alt-right propagandist, Steve Bannon, have begun a war on federal workers. They've revived a rule that allows Congress to fire specific workers or reduce their pay to $1. They're also talking about ending any sort of civil service protection for federal employees. We have to remember from American history, the reason civil service protection is bought in, because otherwise you have corrupt political appointees, you have just a completely inept bureaucracy. And this is what they actually want to do. They're actually trying to destroy the government. They are putting, in every agency, they are putting people in charge who are going to either lead plunder, like Rex Tillerson, ExxonMobil CEO as Secretary of State, Scott Pruitt, the fracking-loving politician from Oklahoma, at the head of EPA, right-wing Christian fanatic and privatizer Betsy DeVos at Education, Secretary of Education, or just completely incompetent, like Nikki Haley at the United Nations, who has absolutely no diplomatic experience. Ben Carson at Housing and Urban Development, who actually said before his weeks before he was nominated that Trump shouldn't pick me. I have no experience to run anything. So this is something unprecedented that we're really seeing. But federal workers can fight back by filing lawsuit, using union power, leaking information to the press, Congress, and watchdog groups, and they can even outright hamper the implementation of policy. So it's important to support and encourage federal workers to do that. Now, in terms of more beyond the governmental apparatus, in terms of what needs to happen going forward, there's all sorts of political activity that we can talk about. This includes activism, mobilizing, recruitment, protest. These are all very important forms of political activity, same with electoral politics. But the most important one, and the one that happens most rarely, is genuine organizing. And organizing, what that really means is a collective project to build power. It means strategically reaching out to people and groups not on your side or who disagree with you and figuring out how to win them over. It means having a vision, a broad strategy of how you want to change society and social relations. Now, the problem is one of the parts of civil society that is most powerful and has the most resources are labor unions. And if a national right to work ruling comes down or law passes, they're going to be on the defensive. A lot of them are talking about they may even be completely wiped out. Of course, just because unions are wiped are eliminated does not mean struggles by workers end. But it will be a huge blow. And unions are particularly important because talking to the workers at these factories in Indiana, they would often have wildly differing opinions about politics, about religion, about morality. But they were all in the same organization fighting for the same goal. And this shows one of the big failures of the left. The left is obsessed with rhetorical and linguistic purity. It only wants to be with organized with those who already agree 100%. Right. In the unions, you find that people may only agree on 30% of things, but they're all fighting together. But often on the left, you'll find that people agree on 95% of things and they're mortal enemies. You know, this is something that we have to look for points of unity rather than searching around for points of disunity. And frankly, also, the left is, especially the academic left, it's all about your ability to master jargon or tomes of theoretical work or to know all the various like cues and signs at a meeting. And what the left does is it often makes people feel bad about themselves. And it makes them feel guilty when the goal of organizing is to lift people up, to give them dignity and hope. And this is something we need to get back to. Now, electoral politics can play a role, and particularly on the West Coast, we can see there's been some bright spots at the municipal level. In Seattle, they have a socialist city council member, Shama Sawant, who she's the one who really helped to make turn $15 now, a $15 minimum wage, from just a slogan into reality. That's where the first legislative bill for $15 was passed after she was elected. Portland was able to, in 2016, elect a proponent of rent control because it has a very strong tenants' rights movement there. Essentially, Portland is undergoing an absolute tsunami of gentrification. Because it was always a working class city, there was never really a need for tenants' rights or a widespread need for tenants' rights. Now there's huge displacement because landlords can just say, you need to leave because I'm going to raise your rent by it, or you have to pay me $1,000 more. And so it's that reaction, but it's that organizing that allowed the pro-rent control city council member to be elected. Or we can look to Jackson, Mississippi, with the Malcolm X grassroots movement that has done patient organizing there for over 10 years. Or to Richmond, California, where that's also the result of over a decade of environmental organizing and labor organizing. Richmond is home to a massive Chevron refinery. It's a black and brown city, largely in the East Bay. But patient organizing has allowed these progressive forces, the Richmond Progressive Alliance, to take over the city council and the mayorship. Now, the problem with electoral politics is any movement is controlled by a charismatic politician using it as a primary strategy. So we can see that with Jesse Jackson, with Barack Obama, even Bernie Sanders. And if they win, the movement falls apart. That's what happens with Obama. If they lose, as with Jesse Jackson, the movement also falls apart. You know, Bernie Sanders is trying to keep his movement going, Our Revolution. But the problem is, there's very little input. There's no real democratic practice. Even Ralph Nader, during his 2000 run, where he got 2.7 million votes, he could not provide the Green Party with the energy or resources to build a viable third-party force. So to fight power, one needs power. And to fight an institution like the U.S. government, you need massive institutions. And so I think a primary strategy going forward in terms of where to organize should be at this municipal and county level, particularly cities, right? Cities are places of great diversity, creativity, tolerance. It's everything Trump hates and wants to oppose and destroy, ironically coming from New York City. Cities are also the economic engines of the United States. That's where most of the wealth and income are produced. It's also where 63% of the population lives. And cities are the one place where progressives, the left, people of color, immigrant communities, and labor can all come together to exert real power. So during the Trump era, it's important to build cities up as powerful bastions of non-cooperation, resistance, and protection. So there should be movements in every city, especially progressive cities and municipal counties, that elected leaders issue resolutions modeled on the sanctuary city movement for undocumented immigrants and the movement against the Patriot Bill. But it's vital to go beyond nice-sounding resolutions. A lot of the resolutions that have passed are completely toothless. Resolutions that have teeth involve directing city and county attorneys to design legal strategies to resist federal policies. It means exerting strong civilian control of the police. The Trump administration will try to enlist local police as frontline troops to persecute entire communities. It will take organizing to bring local governments on board with a broader agenda that includes not only blocking Trump's racist policies, but shoring up and expanding protection in general for working people, women's rights, LGBTQ community, unions, and a fair and just transition to a green economy. You can't call yourself a sanctuary city. You know, New York and San Francisco may say, like, oh, we're a sanctuary city. Well, what does that mean to undocumented immigrants when you have average rents of $4,000 for a two-bedroom apartment? So we have to take a much more expansive view. A sanctuary city has to be for everyone, and that's why wage and housing and healthcare issues also have to be primary concerns. And so what we will see is we'll see a lot of Democratic city governments. They'll talk left, but they'll try to do the minimum. They'll hope protests die down. So there's going to be a need to do real base building organizing to get community groups, unions, professional groups, organizations, nonprofits, and businesses on board for strong resolutions and actions. And the strategy should be for a broad-based movement, but with a focused agenda. So bring as many people on board as possible, but don't throw anyone overboard. Resist the temptation to say, well, we can't take on this community struggle because, you know, that we hear like, oh, well, we can't take a strong stand against Islamophobia because a lot of people, you know, buy into the idea of that Muslims are potentially terrorists. You know, once you start throwing one group overboard, then every group is disposable. And like I mentioned, you know, I think one of the most hopeful signs that there's been is the joining up of Black Lives Matter and the Fight for 15 Low-Wage Worker movement, because these are both primary working class issues, right? Police brutality and low wages. And so the base building strategy need to happen within the cities, at the neighborhood levels, within organized labor, within schools, within religious institutions. It's important that real organizing goes on, because if you don't build bases of power, you're not able to really confront these city governments in a strategic manner, right? You can go across cities all across the country, and when you look at who really rules these cities, it's the real estate industry. That's where the wealth is tied up in these cities, billions, or in the case of New York City, probably trillions of dollars worth of real estate. So you are fighting very powerful developers who usually have the mayor in their back pocket. And it's important to find egalitarian issues that build power and also that build unity. And so that's around things like housing, healthcare, family leave, a good education, police brutality. Now, there's also a big question of how one relates to the Democrats. This is, in fact, a perennial question, and they're varying strategies. One is kind of the inside strategy. It's sometimes called entryism, or it's sometimes called a realignment strategy. And what it means is trying to change the Democratic Party from the inside. And this was actually tried in the late 60s by the civil rights movement and labor unions. And they actually had some success, because if you know, the Democrats made this radical shift from this party of the Southern racists to very much more this party of, you know, not just the industrial working class in the North, but also African Americans, women, and Latinos. But there still wasn't the power base to basically cleave the Democratic Party from Wall Street. And for one, 50 years ago, the left was far more powerful, labor was far more powerful, the civil rights movement was far more powerful, and capital was nowhere as powerful as it is today. So I think any idea that you're going to change the Democratic Party solely from the inside is completely misguided. But the strategy of starting a third party completely from the outside, from the ground up, this is also a complete dead-end strategy. The simplest way to describe it is basically elections are controlled at the state level. And starting in the late 19th century, states started instituting laws to reinforce a two-party system. And the laws that now exist at the state level, where you often will need thousands or tens of thousands of signatures to get on the ballot, are so restrictive that they're not seen really outside of dictatorships. They're the same type of laws that human rights groups throughout the world will often denounce in Africa or Latin America or Asia. These type of laws are really not known. You don't see them anywhere else in the industrialized world. So trying to start a third party from the ground up is extremely futile because there are so many ways to block its development through all the ballot access laws that exist. But by going through cities where the left and left forces, potential left forces, do have real power, that is what has a lot more potential because you can also pick and choose how you run. In some cities have nonpartisan elections. Some cities it is possible to do third parties, such as in Richmond with the Richmond Progressive Alliance. Vermont has done it at the state level, which I think they're called the Progressive People's Party. But in Jackson, Mississippi, the Malcolm X grassroots movement decided to run as Democrats because that was the only game in town. So rather than trying like one strategy or the other, try whatever strategy fits according to the locale where you live. I think one of the big things is getting liberals to move beyond liberalism, right? Because what was liberal 50 or 60 years ago is now to the left of Bernie Sanders, often to the radical left of Bernie Sanders. Ideas such as state economic planning, controls on the flows of capital, housing as a right, jobs as a right, single-payer health care or even socialized medicine, those were much more common from the 30s, you know, the whole kind of New Deal and post-New Deal era. To win, to actually change the system, we have to figure out strategies where we push liberals to the left. And I think one of the things, you know, we have to be clear is just saying to liberals, you know, what are you so afraid of? Why are you so afraid of single-payer health care or taxpayer-funded higher education? Why is the idea that everyone should have, that it's a right to have a good job, a good home, good schools, a livable community and environment, comfortable retirement? Why is that so threatening? Don't say we can't afford it. There's extraordinary wealth in this country. There is tens of trillions of dollars of wealth in this country. And there's extraordinary wealth around the world. There's the resources to provide everyone in the world for a good quality of life. And there's also the resources to address climate change and move to a truly just planet. But, of course, that means taking away the power that the capitalists, that the corporations have over our lives. It's also important that when we hear people denigrating things like, you know, single-payer health care or free higher or taxpayer-funded higher education as free stuff, that we go after them. Remember that the government under Barack Obama, rewarded Wall Street's massive criminal subprime enterprise with $2 trillion in outright support and more than $30 trillion in credits, loans, and guarantees. It's also important not to defeat oneself before you get started. Liberals and progressives are notorious for telling you what isn't possible. But now we have Trump. And anything is possible if you fight hard enough, long enough, and act strategically enough. Don't say it's impossible. Or it'll never happen. That's what Clinton did with single-payer health care. To put it simply, if it's possible for Donald Trump to become president, then socialism is possible in America. Now, it's important to say what we stand for, right? And I think this still gets back to that question and comment Rosa Luxemburg made more than a century ago. It is socialism or barbarism. We're not fighting for a particular candidate. We're not fighting for a party. We're not even fighting necessarily for, you know, a particular set of policies. What we're fighting for is complete social transformation because the center cannot hold any longer. What we want to do is change the whole system to the point that the Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warrens become the right wing of the Democratic Party. Thank you.
That was Arun Gupta on changing the system. He spoke at the Baltimore Nonviolence Center. Arun Gupta, journalist and activist, was a founding editor of The Independent and the Occupied Wall Street Journal.
You've been listening to Alternative Radio, independent, free, and exclusive to community radio since 1986. Alternative Radio is listener-supported. We take no sponsorship and rely on the generosity of individuals, just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the corporate-controlled media, such as Noam Chomsky, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Gideon Levi, and Yasmin Abdul-Majid. You can access our extensive back catalogue online by visiting araustralia.org. That's araustralia.org. To find out how to obtain an audio or transcript copy of this program, Arun Gupta on Changing the System, or to find out more about the Alternative Radio series, please phone 04 1359 7828. That's 04 1359 7828. Full ordering details can be found on the website araustralia.org. Alternative Radio is distributed via the Community Radio Network. Cameron Granadino recorded the program. AR's founder and executive producer is David Barsamian. Joe Ritchie is AR's general manager and series editor. Our theme music is from the Kronos Quartet album, Pieces of Africa. I'm Shane Elson, and I invite you to tune in next time for another program in the Alternative Radio series.
your eyes.